Welcome to another reality show hosted by Golden Hawk. Join Golden Hawk as she travels down the rabbit hole exploring many of life's mysteries and adventures. Because here at another reality show, we're not afraid to let our imagination soar and our intuition run wild. So relax, get comfortable, because for the next 2 hours, we're inviting you to open your heart, spread your wings, and fly. And now, here's Golden Hawk.
Hello, hello everybody. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am indeed Golden Hawk, and I am really excited about today's show. I am kicking off a series of 4 interviews, all basically from guests that I have not played with or spoken with for... Well, today's guest I haven't spoken with since 2008. And, you know, there's a definite feeling of, there's a kindred spirit feeling between me and my beautiful guest today. And, you know, living in, you know, the time of, it's, you know, November 20th, 2012. There's a lot going on. The energies are going on. So I definitely welcome you to get comfortable, because for the next 2 hours, we're going to share some wonderful, fascinating information that's very applicable right now, and, you know, we'll just make everybody feel good on their journey. So everybody, please help me give a warm welcome to Richard Salva. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you, Goldie. It's a pleasure to be on your show again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. It's been too long, actually. I'm glad. But, you know, I understand the journey. You know, it's been a very interesting journey deep down the rabbit hole within myself, so...
Yes, yes, we're constantly growing and constantly exploring new abysses within ourselves.
Yes, yes. So, and I do want to make the announcement. Richard will be taking callers and taking your questions. Of course, you know, what'll probably end up happening is we'll do the first hour of the show. Richard will share his amazing information. And then if you want in the second hour, definitely feel free to call in and ask a question. The number is 646-929-2084. And if you want to ask a question, press 1. Because we have Richard is a plethora of information, and he is somebody who genuinely walks the talk. So if there's a spiritual question, if there's a question, you know, based on the topics that we're talking about, definitely feel free to call in. So, but for now, we're going to focus on the reincarnation of Abraham Lincoln. When this book was written a few years ago, correct?
Yes, yes. It was written a number of years ago. I was actually traveling across country on an airplane in between various creative projects, and I was wondering what to work on next. Actually, all the doors to creativity in a spiritual sense of sharing with people had closed one by one, and I was wondering what to work on. So I just sat in meditation and opened myself up to God, to the universe, and asked for an inspiration of something to pour my energies into. And within less than a minute's time, the idea for this book came to me. And it wasn't a very sort of vague thought at all. It was a very clear thought. I was reminded of something that Paramahansa Yogananda had said. Now, Yogananda was a great spiritual master, a great master of yoga, and he was the author of the classic Autobiography of a Yogi, and which has inspired millions throughout the world, including the Beatles, Elvis Presley, many, many other people. And he said that Abraham Lincoln had been an advanced Himalayan yogi in a past life, and that he was reborn as Charles Lindbergh, the great aviator. And suddenly it just occurred to my mind, here were two individuals whose life stories had been so deeply chronicled. You know, wouldn't it be possible if they're, you know, these were the same soul reincarnated in two lifetimes, to find evidence of that fact in various ways? And the other side of it was also an open door for me, because I'd been at that time practicing and teaching the deeper teachings of yoga for the meditation and so on for more than 20 years. So I knew that if there was also evidence in both men's lives related to a past life practice of yoga, that I should also be able to spot that. So I just started going through the stories of their lives. Especially for Lincoln, I chose books primarily by people who had known him and wrote about his habits, his ways of doing things and ways of speaking and so on. And for Lindbergh, I chose mostly his writings, but also there was were a great many biographies of him as well that were helpful. And, you know, I wasn't sure, Goldie, when I first got started on this, what I would find. I thought I might find a few interesting connections between the two men, but I was overwhelmed by the quantity and quality of connections between the two men. I ended up uncovering, this was a journey that took me almost about 10 years. I ended up uncovering nearly 500 fascinating similarities and connections between the two men, and among them and also the ancient spiritual science of yoga. And these connections are not the typical usual connections that you find between individuals. For these two men, for instance, that they're both male and they're both born in America and so on. But very, very specific things, very unusual things, such as the fact that both men were victims of crimes of the century. That is a very small list of individuals.
What does that mean, crime of the century?
Something that happened in both men's lives that were defined by that term, crimes of the century. For Lincoln, of course, it was his assassination, which isn't really captured in the movie that just came out by Spielberg about him. They just sort of refer to it and show his son's a very intense emotional reaction to it, which I think is a very interesting way of doing that.
Is that Spielberg for you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's a genius. And and then for Lindbergh, it was the famous Lindbergh kidnapping. His son was kidnapped, and this was a big thing in the media and throughout the country. Everybody was wondering what happened to, you know, little Charles and the search for him and so on. And this just captured, you know, America for a number of years. So, very, very small list of people who would be connected with something like that. I've just got long lists of things that just, and some of these things intertwine. You know, the fact that both men married women who were about a foot shorter with dark hair from prominent families, who both spoke French, had secondary learning at a time when not so many women did, that they were married in the house of a relative of the woman in a private ceremony. It just goes on and on. All these things are just interconnected together.
When you're exploring it, I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just one thing after another. And another amazing thing for me, Goldie, was I would be reading something about one of these men's lives. And then just, the thought would occur to me, I wonder if there's also a connection in the other man's life. And that very day or the next day, I would be in a bookstore or a library, and I would see just the spine of a book with a title on it. And it may not... I don't think in any of these cases where this happened, it wasn't a biography of the man. It was something touching very obliquely on their life. And then something would compel me to take that book down off the shelf and open it up, and on the very page that I would open it to would be the answer to the question that I was looking for.
Wow.
Yeah, and this didn't happen just once, but over and over again. I mean, there's a real strong sense of guidance. This book kind of took over my life for a long period of time. I'm surprised I have any friends left.
it's the life of the expanded self. I mean, which, you know, when for those of us who are genuinely on that journey, there's nothing but that life.
Yes, and especially when you're given some sort of dharma or a spiritual duty to, you know, perform. Sometimes you just have to go where that takes you, you know, and whatever happens, you know, because you're just going with your bliss inside and the feeling, the joy of that. And that's you know, Christ said that was your meat, you know, that you eat, you know, doing the will of the Father, you know, just doing, you know, that following that inner guidance, you know, when you're really feeling it. I mean, I felt like I was riding a wave, sometimes just barely hanging on to the board, but, you know, just up there anyway. It was a beautiful thing to experience.
Nice. Okay, so so keep going, though. I mean, you're on this is a good roll. Okay, so you're finding, you're not just finding coincidences. Even the way you're finding the connections between these two men is clearly spiritually being guided.
Yes. So it really felt like it was something I was meant to do. And it's interesting, too, because there are many different ways of approaching this book. There's so much in it. Yogananda's direct disciple, Swami Kriyananda, thought that it deserves to become a classic, and I think the reason he said that was because there is so much in it, and it not only tells us by reading these hundreds of connections, it reminds us of the sort of connections that happen to us all the time. You know, every day, various things, you meet someone and you feel like you've known them forever.
Absolutely.
You go through various experiences in life, and you just sort of, oh, that's interesting, and you toss it off. But if you were to combine them all together, as I've done in this book, then you start to see that it's really a journey that doesn't just start in this lifetime. It started a long, long time ago. And usually when we have an interest ourselves in a particular past life, a past life of our own, it's because it's related directly to something happening in our life right now. And we need to clarify it, perhaps heal from it, whatever it may be, learn from it before we can move forward. You know, the illustration, Goldie, I like to use is that it's as if you're walking on a path in a deep, thick woodland, and you get stuck with a thorn, something, you know, you're pushing through bushes and a thorn snags you, and it wounds you, but you're not aware of it. And the thorn is on a very long vine, a really long creeper. So you just keep walking forward on your path, and you don't notice this little wound until one point the vine becomes taut. And at that point, it starts to dig into you. And if you were to just continue to move forward without doing anything about it, you would wound yourself even worse. And so what you have to do at that time is you have to turn back in the direction that you came from just long enough to release that thorn. And then you're free to move forward, right? And that's what you do with past life things. You just look back into a lifetime long enough to release whatever it is, and then you move forward. Because some people can get stuck in their past lives. You know, they
yes,
start to learn.
Yes, I've met a few.
Yes. I remember one person I met who was like that, very fascinating. She showed me paintings that she had found of a woman, and it looked just like her. And she was talking about this experience that she'd had where she'd lost her love of her life at a very young age. It was very tragic. And when just listening to her, it just felt right. It felt like, yes, she had actually found the best life. But instead of clearing it, she was holding on to it. She would have all these paintings of the person, you know, that she lost, and was just reliving the grief of it without really trying to heal from it. And I saw that, you know, this is the trap that somebody can get into if they're interested in past lives. You know, others might say, well, what if past lives aren't real? You know, I go to these people and they do a regression, and, you know, what if past lives aren't real? And I say, well, who cares if it's helping you? You know?
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
If somebody, and you start talking about this, you know, person who lived during, you know, the French Revolution or whatever it is, and by going through that, suddenly you no longer have this great fear, you know, of whatever it may be. Then why not? You know. So.
Well, you know, and being a client of hypnosis myself, I healed a tremendous part of my journey in this lifetime through hypnosis. I not only know that absolutely playing, you know, exploring past lives is definitely the potential for the benefits of it are grand, but there are tremendous amounts of documented cases where they go and they look up these people's names and where they lived, and they're very real. These people, you know, as much as it could be, you know, maybe something that's made up, you know, it really does deserve the science that it is also been documented that it's quite real.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, there was a famous case that sort of got the whole ball rolling in the 50s about Bridie Murphy and a woman who remembered having been living in Ireland in the past life. Just sort of came through with a hypnotist who was, what the heck is this, you know, hypnotherapist. And
right.
Then they explored it, and just they have found the information in this very obscure, you know, room, you know, where they maintain that sort of information way from way back when, that this person
mm-hmm.
had actually lived and so on. And, you know, it really lends some validity to it. But I think, too, sometimes people... they feel a connection with someone who is very well known in a past life. You know, people often complain, how come there's so many famous people being reborn? What about everybody else? You know, and, you know, I think part of that is, well, the people who talk about it, you know, tend to be, you know, for one thing, if, you know, it's not all that exciting to say, well, I was Joe the farmer or Jane, you know, the midwife, you know, I mean, certainly wonderful
right.
callings in whatever lifetime, but, you know, it is not that much to get excited about. But if you had been somebody, you know, more well-known, then it's, you know, they would want to talk about it. But I think, too, people tend to identify with a particular person at a particular time in history because they had lived at that time, and that person tends to personify that time. So,
okay.
you know, reading about them, so looking at the clothes they wear and the paintings of them, you know, and so on, that all feels so familiar, you know, and maybe you knew that person or you were just very aware of them and that it made an impact on your life, you know, for whatever reason. People tend to identify to some degree the people who are well-known when they're alive, you know. That's why we're so fascinated by reading about Brad and Angelina and all these people, you know. It's just, you know, there's a sense of identification, you know. In some future lifetime, you read about those people and you say, oh, you know, I feel a connection with them because of the time period they lived, because of the way they dressed, because of the way they spoke, the things they said, you know, everything resonates with you. So I think sometimes people say, oh, I think I was so-and-so, really means I lived at the time of so-and-so.
Right on, right on. That feels right to me. Yes. Well, and, you know, it seems to be, like, my experience right now, being November 20th, 2012, there are definite spiritual, I don't want to call them laws, but spiritual truths that seem to be more accepted today than maybe, say, you know, even as less as, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, the idea of reincarnation and karma, you know, it seems to be much more mainstream, these
yeah.
concepts.
Yes, and, you know, I mentioned Yogananda earlier. And mm-hmm. his autobiography, The Yogi, a lot of the reason why these things are moving forward, well, there's two aspects to this. One is that because of his writings coming out, Yogananda came to America in the 1920s, spent most of his life in the States, in the West, sharing these deeper teachings of yoga. He went around, he was like kind of like a rock star of his own time. He went around giving lectures to thousands. You know, he met the president at the time, Calvin Coolidge.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, he was famous. People went to his talks. He made a big splash of his own when he came. But he just started
okay.
to get people in this hemisphere to think more along these lines. And more we just see that people are just becoming more and more open to it. And I think one reason the 60s happened as it did, with so much interest in Eastern spirituality and yoga and so on, and continuing on from there, is because of his influence, you know, helping to open that door very, very wide. But, you know,
yeah.
there's another aspect to it, something that Yogananda's teacher, his name was Sri Yukteswar, He wrote a book called The Holy Science, in which he described something called the Yuga system, which is an understanding of how time works in a cyclical fashion. In India, that's an understanding that they developed a long time ago. And Sri Yukteswar corrected some errors in those calculations to show that we are in a rising age now. There's a 24,000-year cycle, 12,000 years of rising, 12,000 of descending, and we've come just out of the bottom of that flow around the year 500 AD, and we've been moving upwards since then. And you can see the civilization just growing since then, our understanding, technology's grown. Everything in the last, especially 100 or 200 years, it's like everything has just taken off, you know, really fast. The world is a totally different place than it was a couple hundred years ago, say in Lincoln's time. And it continues to change that way very quickly because we're in an age of energy. And we're coming through and out of this. There's a 200-year bridge between the age of matter, which we've come out of called Kali Yuga, and into this second age of Dwapara Yuga of energy, where our understanding, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity is saying that energy and matter is energy, equals mc squared. They're part and parcel of the same thing. And if you look at your hand under an electron microscope, you'll just see spinning electrons and space in between. It's all an energy. It's just a holding pattern of energy. And all of nature is that way. And this understanding is going to continue to grow. And this is something that Sri Yukteswar predicted in 1897, somewhere around there, when he wrote the book.
Oh, wow.
He made a number of predictions that have come true in that book. At that time, they thought that there were a few, perhaps I think a few other galaxies, these fuzzy areas in the sky that you see with the poor telescopes they had then. They thought there were, well, maybe another few other galaxies. Now they realize that there are 500 billion galaxies, each with 500 billion stars or something like that, that the universe is much greater. And Sri Yukteswar spoke about it, our understanding of that, and that we would find these other these other galaxies and so on as our understanding grew. But this is why we see this growth, and why those of us who are working on ourselves spiritually feel a sense of optimism, you know, because we're coming out of a time, and we still have some old thought forms that were from the old age of matter. But those are being broken by this understanding that matter is energy, one by one, until our understanding comes into a new form that takes into account this deeper wisdom. And so it's an ongoing flow, and we've gone through the birth cycle, and now we're just in our infancy, I think. But it's an interesting time that we live in, for sure.
Definitely. Now, you mentioned we've gone through the birth cycle. Can you share that? This is actually a personal question, because I have the sense that I'm in the birth canal, and I'm very curious. When you say we've gone through the birth cycle, can you share more with me where that sense comes from you?
Well, it's from this change from one age to another. That, you know, from the age of matter, which ended around, say, 1700.
Oh, I see.
Yes,
okay.
Until in the 1900, there's a 200-year bridge there. And then, you know, we have Benjamin Franklin with his kite experiment and electricity and everything, you know, that's come from that. And then, you know, on to transportation, the shrinking of space, where, you know, it used to take, you know, months to get from one part of the world to another. Now it can take a number of hours, you know. And electronics and computers and so on like that. This is more of a global phenomenon.
Right. So if I can ask you, because I believe that the going from matter to energy is absolutely, Carolyn Mace actually depicts it happening at the time we did the atom bomb, because she says when we split the atom, we actually... It flipped from matter coming first and then energy to the being energy coming first and then matter. That's a whole other story, though. I just had to add that. But because my thought is how this shifting, or how this birthing, is affecting consciousness. Like, what's the practical ways that the truth of our reality is that by knowing we are energy as a as a reality, how is it practical in you know, 'cause it hasn't really shown up from the point of view where, you know, we have a harmony with the natural environment. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying, and I mean this, of course, more from the programs of the government and medicine, you know, seems very much more that it's gone into pro-business as opposed to pro-curing and pro-healing.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, this flip has taken us in a direction that doesn't seem to have shown up yet for the harmony of the essence of the planet.
Right, right. Well, when there's a birth happening, you know, there's a lot of apparent disharmony. You know, the
right.
labor and everything that goes on with it. Each person will feel the effects of this growing understanding. The way that it's caused physically is that our planet, in its cycles, is moving closer, little by little, to the center of the galaxy. And as it does,
okay.
the more rays of enlightenment and understanding come to each man. But we can only receive that to our own capacity. And so.
Okay.
People, you know, there's still going to be, you know, it's a more enlightened age, but it's not a fully enlightened age to understand that
okay.
matter is energy. There'll still be war, there'll still be conflicts, there'll still be so on and so forth. But, eventually over time, we'll come into there are two further ages to go to. One is understanding the subtle effects of magnetism, which is Treta
okay.
Yuga, the third age, and then the last one is called Satya Yuga. It's the age of spirit, understanding that everything is spirit. And in that age, pretty much everyone on the planet, you know, is like Gandhi or someone like that. Yeah,
they're completely aware.
Yeah, and completely in harmony with nature, completely in harmony with each other, you know, the lion lying down with the lamb. I mean, there's harmony throughout all of nature. And
Okay, thank you for sharing that. I do appreciate
mm-hmm.
that. Because
mm-hmm.
you know, I can't have you on the show and not ask these deep questions.
Yeah, absolutely. yeah.
But back to Lincoln.
Yes.
Because I am curious about something. This is pretty popular, and this came out pretty much about 4 years ago. There was talk about Obama being the reincarnation of Lincoln.
Right.
What do you have to say?
Yeah, my take on that. I was interested in that. I noticed that there were a number of psychics who said that he was a reincarnation
yeah.
of Lincoln.
Yeah.
And the thing that I have to from my perspective is I've done this whole research on this book showing all these hundreds of connections between Lincoln and Lindbergh. Lindbergh lived till 1976, I believe. When I think Obama was like 10 years old or something like that. So, to me, I don't think that he's a reincarnation of Lincoln, but I think that he's inspired by Lincoln.
Okay.
And I think he did, I just have a sense, somebody else thought that he was someone else who had lived in that time period who had, you know, aspirations toward the presidency, was perhaps deeply affected by Lincoln. And so on. There are a number of connections between Obama and Lincoln, but of course, Obama, especially when he was running for president, looked to make more connections. The more, the merrier. You know, to
oh, right.
connect
well,
with
that
Lincoln.
Makes sense. Of
yeah,
course.
And any
right.
politician worth his salt would have done the same. And you know, and but he, but I, if anyone listening believes that Obama is the reincarnation of Lincoln, and more power to you, because I think the more people who can visualize Obama, you know, inspired by Lincoln, the better, you know, the better for the planet, better for the nation, better for everybody, because Lincoln was about as high as you can get for someone, you know, having a dharma of being a politician. So,
right on. Okay. Yeah. I feel that. Yes, right on.
And we're talking about Lincoln. This is, I think, a good segue into just talking a little bit about Lincoln's spirituality, which I'm not sure that...
I was just going to say that, too.
Yeah. Well, we're right on the same page here, so that's good.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Kindred and, spirits, my friend.
Yeah. So, in you know, that was one thing I was looking for, the connections between Abraham Lincoln and the spiritual science of yoga. And the reason for that is... not only because Yogananda said he was a Himalayan yogi, an advanced one in a past lifetime, but also that yoga is a lot more than what most people think of it. Most people think of yoga as yoga postures, you know, the headstand, the lotus pose, you know, various things. Those postures that are taught, you know, many millions of people are going to their studios and practicing these postures, which are great for health and so on, and can calm the mind and so on, are helpful that way. These postures were actually developed to allow yogis ultimately to be able to sit still for long periods of time in meditation. The yoga itself is not considered by those who understand it to be some sort of separate religion with its own belief system and so on like that. What happened was the origins of yoga, it was first written down by a great sage called Patanjali, who lived in India before Christ, a couple centuries before Christ. And he wrote down a book called the Yoga Sutras, in which he was describing an understanding that had been already carried forward for who knows how many centuries in India. And in this book, what he was describing was how a person grows and changes in the various, you know, step-by-step process of becoming more spiritual until, well, you know, you sort of start at the beginning acting like an animal, and at the end you're acting like an angel. Yoga itself, the word yoga means union. And what he was referring to was union with spirit, union with God. And so he's describing what happens to everybody, whether, you know, you're somebody who's a monk or a nun in a Catholic monastery, or somebody who's a Buddhist, you know, practicing, or somebody who's not part of any religion at all and is just growing very deeply spiritually, either from past life influences or what have you. He just described it, you know, this is what you do. You go through this step, this step, this step, and he called it, it's called the Eightfold Path of Yoga. And so this was the essential thing that I was trying to look for when looking at Lincoln, very specific teachings on exactly how one grows. You know, then these things have, although it's a universal phenomenon, in India they have a certain way of expressing it, teaching it, practicing it. You know, and I was looking for signs of those things in the life of Lincoln, and I found some very, very interesting things. Should I go ahead and go through some of those things?
Absolutely. And if we can, at the very least, at least before the end of this conversation, I would love it if all, I guess if there's eight of them, if all eight could be shared, that would be wonderful.
Yes. Okay.
But yes, yeah. I mean, if you want to do one and then do examples, whatever, you know, however it flows. So.
Yeah. You know, I want to preface this by just giving a little, sharing a little bit about my own experience. I call myself a connoisseur of consciousness, and I love to go on pilgrimage. I love to go to places on this planet where great souls had lived. You know, I've never been to the Holy Land. I'd love to go there. But I've been to other places. I've been to Lourdes, I've been to Assisi, I've been to, you know, various places where great souls have lived, and or God somehow is said to have manifested somehow, and just go there and experience it. And after now getting close to 40 years of hours of daily meditation, you know, you really start to develop, anyone would experience the same thing, you would develop a sense of real sensitivity for particular just little differences in energy and vibration. For instance, in the town of Assisi, where you go, where St. Francis had lived and was inspired in the Portiuncula Chapel, there's a particular energy there. You call it a vibration. It's very powerful. It's very uplifting. It's very beautiful. And then in the same town, there is a basilica for St. Clair, who was, you know, sort of his partner in the spiritual work. And she, you know, is buried there. And there's also a beautiful energy there, but it's very different. You know, it's a little bit more, you know, powerful in the heart. You know, it just really opens up the heart. And in Francis's, the heart was involved also, but it was also really strong at the spiritual eye, at the point between the eyebrows, you know, at the Christ center.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, it's just each place has its own, you know, particular flavor, as you might call it. And, but I was very sensitive to where someone like that might be, to the extent that, just to give you one example, I was traveling with a friend and I was in Florence, Italy, and we went to the Great Basilica there. And we found ourselves in a room, and I knew some Italian, but not enough to be fluent in it. But we were just traveling, and there were these displays there. And when I got in the room, I said to my friend Dave, I said, Dave, I just feel so deeply inspired just being here in this room. I don't know what it is. And then I looked more closely at the displays, and suddenly I just slapped my forehead. We were surrounded by relics from various saints that had found their way there over the centuries, you know, the finger bone of John the Baptist, and, you know,
et cetera,
you know, all these little relics in the Middle Ages.
Right, energetic items.
yeah, and, you know, if they're a saint, then there'll be a spiritual energy, a blessing around those things, and I felt it before I even knew that those were there. And so anyway, I had, at a certain point, I had been working on my book for a few years, and I'd found so much information, and I was just, like I said, overwhelmed by it. And I just had this sense that, you know, okay, you know, mentally, I accept this, what Yogananda said. It just seems to make sense. The more I look into it, the more it seems true. The more you see while writing about Lindbergh or about yoga practices, you the outline of Lincoln, and you see his face drawn in, then you start to see the shading and everything. I mean, it's just a pretty obvious, you know, to me that it was true. But I wanted to feel it. I wanted to feel it. So I planned this trip, and I flew from the West Coast to St. Louis and got a rental car, and I drove to Springfield, where Lincoln had lived. And I wanted to go visit the places where he had been to see what it felt like there, to see if I could feel what Yogananda was talking about, an advanced Himalayan yogi incarnating in that planet in America at that time to help guide us through one of the most difficult times in our existence, to help us to bring forward, to actually help us to redefine our country through the Gettysburg Address and so on, everything that he did to free the slaves. Yogananda said that this was Himalayan yogi had a strong desire to help to bring about racial equality in the planet. And he had died with that desire. And whenever we die with any sort of strong thought or feeling, it has a big impact on our future lifetime. And, you can imagine some yogi living in India and perhaps seeing, you know, the horrible effects of the caste system there and maybe having that desire come out of that, you know.
Which
caste system was meant to be something different than what it is now, but we won't go into that because that could be another show. But anyway, I went to where Lincoln had lived, and I started to feel an inspiration there. And it was pretty amazing to me because my head was so fuzzy. As I had taken a red-eye flight, I was half asleep, but still half awake, but I was energized so much that I became fully awake, especially when I went to where the Lincoln Law Office was, where he practiced law with Billy Herndon, his partner, and where he conceived many of the political ideas that helped to catapult him to the presidency eventually. But there was an inspiration coming through there because this is a great soul becoming president of the United States at a critical time. There was a divine plan here. There was a guidance there. And, just sitting in that office, I did not want to leave. I wish I could have just spent hours there meditating. It was so powerful and so beautiful. And I recognized there, and also I went to New Salem, where nearby Springfield, where Lincoln grew up as a young man, felt the same energy there. The beautiful soul here, this is really an advanced soul. And anyone who's sensitive can, I think, feel it at anywhere where Lincoln had been. And it's a good another excuse to go to any of those places, just to go there and just find a quiet spot and just sit and meditate. But
and feel and experience, you know, because is it a fingerprint or a footprint of some sort left by his presence, or is there a way to describe this?
Yeah, it's an energy footprint or thumbprint.
Okay.
You know, someone who is advanced spiritually is radiating energy. It's like their body molecules are vibrating at a quicker speed than others. And that can manifest if someone has the ability to see an aura, as a brighter aura, a larger aura. An aura of your average person maybe goes out a few feet from their body. The aura of a great saint would extend out a great distance. And it's not through ego. It's not through them as a person. It's a sign that they, as they grow spiritually, that they're releasing the ego, and they're allowing the divine to work through them more and more. And so you see, you know, even in the Middle Ages, before they really understood this, you'd see these halos, you know, in the paintings of saints and so on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you'll just, if you see someone who's very advanced spiritually, you'll just see this light in them and around them. I see that in Swami Kriyananda, Yogananda's direct disciple, when I see him. He's just like a light moving around, you know, wherever he is. It's just such a beautiful thing to see. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this was the sort of experience I had for Lincoln, but it was very interesting because it was inspiration. And there, I could feel this sense. Lincoln had this problem with melancholy in his lifetime, the sadness. And you could feel that even in the inspiration, it was just sort of, and it didn't detract from it, it gave it a very personal feel. And it was like a little bit of spice in the soup to give it flavor, was the way I like to put it. And you know, you can sense some of that too where he lives. So it's rather interesting. But anyway, so.
Before you go on, I just want to say, because this comes up in my other show that I do, the Mystical Mother Earth show, we often say this journey is never just about, you know, the feeling good. It is, we're in a dualistic experience. So, you know, the fact that, you know, Lincoln had melancholy is actually quite poignant to me, because there's too many people that don't want to, you know, embrace that side of themselves. It's, you know, it's always about getting rid of it or excavating it or, you know, diminish it. And it's like, in my humble opinion, it's really about, just like you said, you know, kind of integrating it as it's part of the journey and should be respected as just as sacred as the bliss.
Yes, well, I believe that too, that there are parts of ourselves that we negate because we don't understand those parts of ourselves. And when we do, and when we can incorporate it into our greater being, we won't be at war with ourselves in that.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll be more one, we'll be integrated inside of ourselves more deeply. And it's just really understanding what it is, because every trait has its highest aspect to it. And it's just a question of understanding that and finding that and just bringing, you know, it all together inside of ourselves. But again, this is another, you know, yoga is such a great word because it means so many things. You know, in yoga postures, people talk about the union of body and mind, the union, you know, various union. But the deepest union that happens when we unite with spirit, all parts of ourselves are fused together and united as well. And
Because I think it's important that, because I hear a lot of people really just, you know, they don't speak of that side,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah, and
I don't
yeah.
know why.
Yeah. Well, Shakespeare said, my mind to me a kingdom is, and there's just so many parts of our nature, and if we could just, you know, really befriend every part of ourselves, then, you know, there'll be this great energy that'll come through us, because it won't be at cross purposes anymore. It'll all be going in the same direction, like the energy of a magnet. A magnet has energy because all the molecules are aligned in the same direction. But a regular piece of steel doesn't have that magnetism because each molecule is going every which way. you know, ended.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
Yeah.
Nice. Very nice. Yes.
And the thing that magnetizes the seal is the flow of energy going through it to help to align all those molecules going in the same direction. That's where higher meditation practices that move energy through you, you know, that were designed by great masters, great saints. These things can help us to grow spiritually. That was the one thing that Yogananda taught, was a teaching called Kriya Yoga. And that is an energy meditation practice that aligns the energy within us. It helps you to grow spiritually very quickly. If you really tune into it, so.
Nice.
But you have to do it with your heart too. It's not just all mechanical. It's you have to do it with love and with devotion. So,
well, because in my humble opinion, in the alignment, you're going to be it's going to be brought into your awareness,
mm-hmm.
both sides. You
mm-hmm.
know. Because that's the journey isn't about, I think a lot of people do energy work in order to escape the melancholy side,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or the, you know, whatever the shadow, however the shadow shows up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, the point isn't to escape it or run away from it. The point is to understand it and its purpose,
mm-hmm.
and then it will elevate you as opposed to, you know, be the anchor that holds you down.
Well, I think too, the shadow represents something that's unknown, and we fear the unknown.
Right.
But once you
right.
know it, I mean, if you meditate a lot, eventually you're going to know every part of you. You know, there's no
yeah,
getting away
true.
From it. You know, if you're really sincere and you're really trying to develop, you're going to get to know yourself really, really well, every doggone aspect of yourself. And so
every doggone aspect.
There's no hiding it. I mean, you're basically sitting in front of a mirror, just, you know, you're just so, so there you go.
Right on.
So let's see. Let's take a look at, then at Patanjali's Eightfold Path. I'll give a quick overview to start, and then we'll just look at each one of these one by one, and just take
Perfect.
A peek at Lincoln's life and see if there's any signs.
Okay.
The first two steps they're moral guidelines for life, and the idea is, you know, there are five guidelines for each step, so there are 10 in total. And people sometimes say, "Oh, these are like the 10 commandments of yoga," but they're more like suggestions. And the idea is, if you are trying to fill your bucket of your consciousness with peace, if you keep riddling it with holes, it's all going to leak out. And so, if you're in various ways in life, you know, if you're not honest or truthful. If you try to hurt others, you know, various things like that, it's going to rob you of what you're trying to develop spiritually. And so this is sort of like the foundation. But even to master each of these things, it's like the only one who really masters it is when you've gone the whole distance. So it's like
okay.
each of these things are like an eight limbs coming out of the center. It's like an octopus, I guess.
Okay. You know,
I've never
okay.
heard it compared that way, but I mean, it makes sense, you know. And they're all connected, interconnected together, more than like the base of a pyramid sort of thing. But there are, like I said, there are five of each, and some of these relate more strikingly to Lincoln's life than others. So some of them I'll talk more about, and some I might either just touch on or perhaps just mention what they are and say, you know, even though there are some things, it's not all that fascinating. So, the first one is nonviolence. Now, these the first ones are called yama, which mean control, which means you just don't want to do these things. And the other five are you definitely want to do these things. You know, so these are the things you don't want to do. You don't want to hurt anyone or anything as much as you can. These things are also, I would like to say, to some degree, they're more a state of consciousness than what you can do perfectly in the physical world. For instance, if you can be nonviolent, but as soon as you step in your car and start the engine and start driving, you're killing hundreds of insects. So it's really hard to do this perfectly in the physical world, but if you're in your consciousness, you wish no harm to anyone or anything, what eventually you find is that even like violent people or, you know, like wild animals will become like tame or peaceful in your presence. when you mount.
Right on.
You know,
right
that,
on.
And you see that. So,
yeah.
I mean, even in Lincoln's life, there's this really funny story. His law office, there was some sort of like a trap door in it, and it
okay.
opened up in downstairs to where either it was a meeting room or they were doing, you know, trying people there with the judge and, you know, lawyers and so on or whatever. And something happened downstairs that Lincoln heard upstairs where there was a fight broke out. And Lincoln just opened up the trap door and dropped down to the lower level.
Oh my God.
And somehow through his presence, people calmed down. And it just sort of broke up the fight just by him being there. Now,
you know, I'll be honest, I know people, I have friends of mine, young people.
Yes.
And I call them the peacemakers.
Yeah.
And they, I've seen them in bars, you
mm-hmm.
know, back in my heyday. Literally, their presence being at the pool table
mm-hmm.
immediately shifted the energy where the two people who didn't even know my friend
yeah.
immediately stopped arguing and
mm-hmm.
very organically just
yeah.
found a state of peace. Because
yeah.
his, and I used to tell him, it's because you were there. And he'd be like, no, don't be silly. And I'm like, I'm not being silly. It's because you were there.
Yeah, yeah. A peacemaker
yes.
is someone who sheds peace. They radiate peace.
Mm.
It's an energy flow that suddenly, you know, that wasn't such a horrible thing. You know, the person isn't so bad.
Exactly.
You know, you start thinking, you just start thinking.
Yes.
It's
yes.
a state of consciousness, and it's a
yes.
flow of energy. And someone who's deeply in tune with it will affect others around them if their energy flow is stronger than the anger, stronger than what's going on around them. It's
right.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. So
yes.
when looking at Lincoln's life again, when he was a child, a boy of his acquaintance when he was growing up in Indiana, southern Indiana, killed a tortoise, a terrapin they called it, with a rock. It was just a very cruel thing. And Lincoln was so horrified by that that he, even as a little boy, he wrote this tract against cruelty to animals. It's kind of interesting.
Mm.
When he was older, and they show this in the movie in a very humorous way, he didn't like wearing leather gloves. His wife kept trying to get him to, you know, dress better. You know, he's supposed to be this, you know, representing people, and you know, if you're going to be a politician,
prestigious.
you got to look the part.
Right.
Yeah, and
right.
Would keep throwing the gloves down. He did this in the movie over and over again. And he said, I think these look better on the calf, you know, because it was calf.
Oh, right
on. Gloves, you know? And that was a line from the movie, which I appreciate they had that in there. They did a really good job, I thought, because I really went into Lincoln's life looking at what he was like as a person. And they captured a lot of that. I thought Spielberg and Dave Lewis did a wonderful job. I really commend them.
Right.
I highly recommend the movie if you haven't seen it. Anyway,
right on, thank you.
Yeah, now this is about animals, but also regarding people. The Lincolns did not spank their kids at a time when almost everyone did and thought it
right.
was just fine. You know, that was the way you raise kids, is the way you can listen. They didn't do that at all. They just thought, well, you know, they're going to grow and they're going to... I have to say, his kids are pretty wild. And that came up in the movie. That came up in the movie, too, where they showed one time he was in his office in the White House, and little Tad just comes, runs in, grabs something off the table, runs right out. That was the way it was in Lincoln's law office. That was the way it was in the White House in Lincoln's day. Tad driving a cart pulled by a goat through the middle of the halls of the White House with his mom. You know, they didn't show the mom doing this, but the mom screaming in the background, Daddy, you can stop that right now. You know, this is what it was like. You know, the kids went wild, and they would just pull on his hair and crawl, you know, climb all over him while he was talking, you know, about a law case in his office and stuff like that.
Patient man, clearly.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is where I disagree in the movie, because at one time he had this very large disagreement with his oldest son, Robert, who he didn't have quite that sweet connection with. And I think to emphasize that during their disagreement, they show Lincoln slapping Robert. I don't think that that ever happened. I don't read anything where he had done anything like that. I think they were trying to make a point, but if I were the director, you know, who would love
no,
me to do that?
No, speaking though, you're on a place where we want to know your opinion because we respect your opinion. Go ahead.
If I were the director, I wouldn't have included that because I don't think it really happened, and perhaps there was another way to show intense disagreement without that happening. Now, he immediately reached out for his son's face to kind of caress it, but even still, you know, I just didn't think that that was true. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and it did happen, and it's something I never read about, but looking at the rest of Lincoln's life, from what I've seen, it's
at a place.
Yeah, it doesn't ring true to me. So, he also
Hollywood will still be Hollywood. Remember, you know.
Yes, they've got to do
on
that
on some level.
So many things that you would kind of recommend differently. Anyway.
Exactly.
Now, Lincoln, as a lawyer, he was an established lawyer, and a young lawyer asked him for his advice. And, you know, it's interesting that Lincoln wrote to him, they said, be a peacemaker. Now, it seems to be contradictory to what, you know, a lawyer would try to encourage people to litigate, you know. But he said, you have a wonderful opportunity to try to make peace between people. And he said, if you can't do that, then he said, perhaps you need to have another line of work, which is very interesting, I thought.
Who was he saying that to?
Someone who wanted to become a lawyer as he grew up.
Young man. Yeah, that is interesting, right?
Already studying for the bar or whatever.
Himalayan was showing.
Yeah, exactly. His Himalayan was showing. That's a great phrase. Jai, well done. Lincoln would get angry at times, but typically only when he saw injustice. You know, he'd slam his hand on the desk and, you know, yell something. But by and large, he was able to keep his cool. He was very much controlled. You know, self-control is something that we'll be talking about in a minute. Okay, the next one is Yama is called non-lying. And here we have Honest Abe. You know, that's a pretty easy match to make. The man who said you can fool some of the people some of the time. He had a personal way of looking at truthfulness. He said, even if you say something at the time, you don't know whether it's true or not, and it just happens to be true, just because it accidentally was true, you were lying because you didn't know. You know, his approach to truthfulness was beyond what I think most people would think was reasonable. And in fact, he was shocked early on when someone lied to him because he expected people to tell him the truth because it just didn't make sense to him. When Stephen Douglas,
Frederick Douglass?
No, not Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass is the African-American man who met Lincoln at the White House, but this is Stephen Douglass, who actually was trying to become president at the same time Lincoln did, but Lincoln was elected over him. And he told them that he would not do something, and then he ended up doing it. And Lincoln was very shocked, never quite trusted him again. Lincoln was also self-honest. You know, somebody who was painting a picture of him said, just try to look natural. And Lincoln, thinking of his own looks, which he used to joke about, says, that's the last thing I want to do. You know, somebody in one of his speeches with Douglas accused him of being two-faced. He said, I leave it up to you. If I had two faces, would I be wearing this one? You know, he had a great sense of humor. And he joked about his hair, which was flyaway in the movie. He said his last barber committed suicide. And then he said in the one before that, too. But, you know, that there's a power, there's an ability that comes to you when you master truthfulness. And that's that anything you say has to come true. Because everything you say is always true. If you say something, it has to come true. And it's interesting that one time during the Battle of Gettysburg, Lincoln was in the White House, and he knew that it was a crucial crux point of the war, and that whoever won that battle, you know, would make a big determination of who would win overall. He got down on his knees in the White House and he prayed, and he had a sense that his prayer was answered. And he came out just glowing, and he said, "I believe we're going to win this battle and win this war." And he saw a man seated there outside of his office in the White House, and his name was General Sickles, and he had been terribly injured in one of the recent battles that had taken place. And Lincoln said, you know, General, I feel prophetic right now, and the doctors are not sure whether you're going to survive your injury, and I want you to know that you will survive. And it's interesting that he did. So it's interesting, you know, that, that ability that comes to you from mastering any sort of spiritual quality.
Well, you know, and I'll be honest with you. 4 years ago, when we had our conversation, our interview, I never forgot you saying that if every time you tell the truth, you know, the way I interpreted it was, if every time I tell the truth, everything I would say would have more influence than not, because because it
from
would be the truth.
Yes. The more in tune you are with truth, the more power your words will have. If you're always prevaricating, if you're never quite, you know, saying the, you know. Now, there's a balance to this. I mean, if you're sitting somewhere and a man goes running by you and he's scared to death and he hides behind a tree and somebody comes up with a gun, says, did you see the gun going by? It's much better to say you don't know or you went that way and point the opposite direction or whatever.
Of course, there's a balance
in the universe. But by and large, you know, there were individuals in the history of India that when the British came in to take over India, they were just amazed that there were people who would not tell a lie, even if it would save their home, their livelihood, or whatever like that. They just wouldn't lie. It was very interesting. And sometimes, you know, sometimes we'll get tested, you know, about our spiritual principles in a very, in a very intense way. So.
Right on.
Yeah, there's more to cover. I think it looks like it's about the hour. Were you wanting to
exactly?
Want to take a little break?
We can take a little break, sure. Okay, just so the audience knows, I'm going to play a song. Give Richard a few minutes. To stretch his legs, grab some water. And then when we come back, again, Richard will continue speaking about the yogas, and we're going to be open to phone calls. So. Why don't I? I'll just play a quick song. It's 3:55 seconds. It's the song from Willy Wonka called "Pure Imagination." I don't know. I had the choice, and I was thinking of it while you were speaking, and this seems to be the one that's hitting me. So, so you have 4 minutes to stretch a little, and then we'll get back to you at approximately 4:06.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll talk to you in a few. All right, everybody can, you know, get up and stretch. Here we go.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
Hurry up, pilot.
This way, Grandpa.
No life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be.
Thank you. Oh, that was a beautiful song. Richard?
Yes, in here.
Yes.
No,
is
I
that
really
break,
I thought that was a great break song.
Oh, thank you. Because I was looking at my songs and I had And When I Die by, and I went, I should have played that one. You know, but I've learned a long time ago, just go. Don't, there is no regrets.
Yeah.
Just.
I really like that song. That was beautiful.
Oh, well, and I'll be honest, though, because when I saw that, there is a beautiful essence of child in your energy.
Mm.
And, of course, that is by no means an insult, but an actual compliment.
No. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, that is truly, because I was like, oh, yeah, Willy Wonka, pure imagination. That's Richard.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
well,
so
shall we take up from where we left off?
Absolutely, that would be fantastic.
Okay, so this is the first step on the Eightfold Path, or the first branch. It's called Yamas, control, and these are things you don't want to do. The next one is non-stealing. You know, there wasn't a lot in Lincoln's life because he just didn't do that. he was worried as president that freeing the slaves would be stealing from the South, and that bothered him for a long period of time, and he was very pleased that he could do it as a military necessity. And again, this is something that was brought out very, very well, very well done in the movie. But I remember one, just more than one time where, this is a thing with Honest Abe Lincoln, too, where a woman had paid him something in the shop that he had in New Salem when he was a young man and had left a penny on the counter. And she lived a number of miles away. And so he went there after he closed the shop in the dark to knock on the door, and she said, what are you doing here? And he had done all that way just to return a penny. And this is where the legend of Honest Abe came from, actually. It's very interesting. The next part of that step, these five different moral guidelines, is non-sensuality or sense control. And this is related to everything regarding the senses, not becoming someone who just loves to eat so much that, you just stuff yourself all the time, but more you practice control even though you enjoy it very much, things like that. Especially can deal with sexuality, though, and it's often mentioned as a prescription, for someone learning to grow spiritually, if they can, sort of balance that energy as much as they can, or have some degree of control over it. The more you're able to do that, the more ability you can develop that ability of sense control, of self-control inside yourself, which can be very powerful, your willpower and so on. I was actually a monk for a few years in my yoga community, and there's a particular approach to monasticism that yoga monks do. And if this Himalayan yogi was also monastic, which is quite probable, pretty much all of them, I think, are sadhus or someone who is a yoga type monk, then they would have these same sort of practices that they did. And these were things that were recommended by Ramakrishna, a great saint in the 18th century, for his followers who wanted to become monks. And the opposite would be hold true for any woman who wanted to develop this in themselves at all as well. But thinking about others of the opposite gender, if you want to become a monk, this is the things that I was taught. You don't look at women. Try not to look at them. You do try not to talk to them. If you do look at them, don't look them in the eye. There's a lot of magnetic exchange in the eyes. You just generally avoid their company in a harmonious way as well as you can. Try to stay as, if you go into town or so on, you have these sort of like bodyguards, which would be other monks around you, and, right. You know, things like that. So same thing for women. They the nuns that we had would generally in a very harmonious way just would not be around you very much, you know, things like that. It went both ways. And now the interesting thing about Lincoln was when he was a young man, he wanted to get married at a fairly young age. He knew that this was one of his goals in life, but he had real problems. He would go into a party determined to talk to some of the young women who were there. He'd be walking toward them. The next thing he knew, he was in another room surrounded by men and hanging out and talking and joking with them. And it was like, how did that happen? You know, and he saw this dynamic happening over and over again. It's like some power would pull him away from women and have them hanging out with men. And it was very frustrating for him. He wrote to someone, he said, I know that a woman is the only thing I'm afraid of that I know will not hurt me. And he when he was around women, he wouldn't talk to them, he wouldn't look them in the eye, he would get all, you know, embarrassed, and he would
flustered.
Be like, yeah, and he would twist one leg like a corkscrew on the other, and he said, like these young women that were in a boarding house that he was in for a while, he said, how do, my name is Abraham Lincoln, my friends will tell you, I can't talk to women, and that's the way that he talked.
That's cute.
As a young man, isn't that funny?
But that is funny.
It's very amusing, but it was very painful for him. But if he'd spent like a lifetime or more just sort of, you know, and not doing it in a transcendent way, perhaps, not fully, but part of your mind just saying, okay, women are bad, just stay away from women, or, you know, whatever, you're creating a negative karma there if you're not able
of
to
course,
do it at the highest level. And that can manifest in your next lifetime. So he had problems in relationships when they did start. There was a legend of him getting courting a young woman named Anne Rutledge in New Salem. A very beautiful story. But the problem was she was engaged to someone else when they met. And then that ended up ending, and they were planning to get married, and then she died. And this was one thing that his law partner said was the foundation of his lifelong sorrow, that he had kind of lost the love of his life at a young age. And I won't go through all the... He had all sorts of problems. Finally, he ended up with Mary Todd. Even at the wedding ceremony, he joked to somebody, said, where are you going? He said, to hell, I suppose. And he looked like white. His whole face was white at the wedding ceremony. It was like some part of him felt, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to do this or something. You see these things come up. Past life habits coming up, you know. Some part of him in the back of his mind saying, what are you doing? You're getting married? You know, some part of him was whispering, you're a monk, you know, or whatever it might be.
Well, I was going to say, is it anywhere if he was conscious of his past life as a Himalayan monk? I mean, did he know that?
You know, I don't know. You know, as we grow spiritually, you know, often these memories will come to us.
Right.
He didn't practice any spiritual practices that would help him to grow spiritually. He, except for occasional prayer, he did spontaneous meditations, which we'll be getting to very, very shortly. But also sometimes if it's not helpful for an individual to fulfill their life mission to have too much of that, then they won't know that. There might be some vague, you know, things in dreams or something that might come up that But he had interesting dreams. Again, we'll talk about that in a minute. The power that comes when you practice self-control is a great mental energy and vitality, and it is often manifest too as incredible memory. Swami Vivekananda was this great yogi who came to America in like the 1890s, and he was staying at a person's house, and he said, "I have a very this advanced memory." And somebody said, "Well, prove it." And so they gave him a book out of the encyclopedia to read. And afterward, they said, "Well, what's on this page?" And he was able to just quote from memory exact text, you know, like a total recall.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. But Lincoln had this incredible ability to remember names and things from years later. One time a man came to visit him in the White House. Lincoln, as a young man, had worked for this man about 15, 20 years ago before or farther, a long time before. And this man said, "You know, I came because I wanted to see you, but I wanted also to ask you, you were sharpening the scythe with a whetstone, but what did you ever do with that whetstone?" And Lincoln remembered. You know, it was 20 years before or whatever, and he remembered. He said, "Oh, I put it at the top right post, just on top of the post there, where Lincoln could see it, but this man who was much shorter couldn't." You know, so that's why.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Solve now, that mystery, right?
Yeah, exactly. Put that to rest. The last yama is called non-attachment. I won't go into it in depth. In Lincoln's first attempt to get office, he said, I quote, "If elected, I will be thankful. If not, it will be all the same," unquote. Mm. And he was not elected.
Really?
Yeah, he had this non-attachment. When the door closed, for a while he thought he might be a name mentioned for president. Then he became interested. When that went away, he just forgot about it. He said, "Let it all go. I'll try to outlive it," about anything that happened in his life. And one other non-attachment was very big. He was non-attached to his own body. He never worried about assassinations. He said, "If somebody wanted to, they could do it. Why should I worry about it?" You know, so quite interesting. Okay,
I respect that kind of freedom. That's a freedom, in my humble opinion.
It is.
You know, I live in an area where people, you know, have, you know, gated communities, but not just gated communities. Their homes are gated, and I always, when I drive by, on some level, go, "Who's the guard? Who's the prisoner?"
Exactly.
You know, what are you keeping out, and what's being kept in? Anyway, so yes, I agree. It's almost one other example. Small. I have friends of mine who keep their cats, their indoor cats, and I say to them, "So they die in a prison. You know, they live longer, but they die in a prison." I mean, because from my perspective, to never walk on grass or have the sun be, you know, on your face in fresh air and not through a windowsill. I wouldn't want that. I'd rather die outside in a shorter term life in the freedom. Of course, you know, my friends are like, "Well, it's not your cat." So,
but I agree with you. I mean, that. I mean, especially if you were a cat, you would want to be able to go outside. But the problem with cats is whenever they're in, they want to go out, and vice versa. But it's still, you know.
But if it's their choice, I honor it. When we make that choice for them, that's when it's.
Yeah,
you know, that next, then, you know, come back as a cat and we'll see how you like
it. Yeah, exactly. So, reincarnation and karma, we got to be careful there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So much intelligence in the eyes of these cats, you know, you wonder what's going on sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel that as well. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
So the niyamas are things that you don't control, but you try to increase inside yourself certain qualities or traits or habits. And so I'll go through some of these real quickly. One was cleanliness, which also doesn't mean just keeping your body clean, but also keeping clear in your own aura, in your own consciousness. Lincoln didn't tend to read the attacks on himself in the paper, although his wife did and would sometimes read them to him. But, you know, things like that. He kept his own company, as his stepmother said, which he said was always good. You know, and so that's one aspect.
Nice.
Another one is contentment, which in the Mahabharata, in Hindu scripture, is called the Prince of Virtues. If you're contented, then everything can grow on that, come from that. And Lincoln said about himself that in me the race of ambition was a failure. So he really had that contentment as well as that non-attachment. The third one is called tapasya, which is austerities, things that you do where you try to just test yourself, do much more than someone else would think reasonable for a spiritual purpose. There are stories of yogis in India who would just go without sleeping for like weeks at a time, who would try this thing like holding an arm up for years, never bringing it down.
Wow.
Always sleeping upright, wow, never lying down. And the ones that are really mastered, you see this glow, there's this glow about them, that they just mind over matter. You know, they are not the body, they are
right,
the spirit. And
right,
those who hadn't mastered it, they'll just have this look of pain, you know, because they hadn't quite able to reach that level that is being called for in there. But Lincoln used to just go beyond, you know, what was needed in so many different ways. And I'll just to give you an example, he waded through an icy river to rescue a dog. He would walk long miles to run an errand or fulfill a promise. He sighed the large field to settle a debt. He would keep his expenses to a minimum and his needs few after achieving success. He tackled law cases for friends and strangers without charge. He took the humblest train accommodations, kept an open ear all his life to anyone in need, saw hundreds of supplicants at the White House, stayed up all night to contemplate deep thoughts or wait for an important telegram, yada, yada, yada. I mean, there was just so much
nice,
to his life.
Nice.
Know? Yeah, yeah. So
sounds like the kind of guy I'd like to have as a friend.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Wouldn't it? Somebody you could always count on. I mean, you could always count
on. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice. We needed a Lincoln in the, well, I now get what you were saying about thinking of Obama as Lincoln, because that really is, I think, that kind of qualities. Several of the ones you've been mentioning today is what inherently, historically, has been missing lately in the White House. So, indeed.
Hey, let's all visualize him as Lincoln, you know, just Lincoln coming through.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, you know, I agree. I think that's a great idea.
I support it as well.
And then the last two of these first two steps, first one is called self-study, and it's been also interpreted as a study of the scriptures, and Lincoln had this ability, and the way that they would study, there was a description of from the autobiography of Yogi of how they used to teach the scriptures in old times. They would just read a passage, and then the person who is the guru would to give a little interpretation of it, and then they would all sit for like an hour or so just thinking about that one truth and just trying to tune into the deepest aspect of it. And then at the end of it, the guru said, do you feel like you've captured it? And one person in the group said, yes. He said, no, not fully. He said, try to feel the inspiration, the power of this truth that has inspired people for so many centuries. And then they would sit for another hour in silence. You know, so it was this deep, going deep into something. And the way Lincoln learned, even as a young man, he would take a phrase or a word and he would repeat it to himself over and over again. It's like he was chewing on it. And he would go deeper and deeper into it until he felt like he'd mastered it. And he did that with everything, including the law, including the U.S. Constitution, which is interpretation of which historians have marveled over for all these years, et cetera, and so on. The power that comes with someone who perfects self-study and introspection and this deeper study is that they're able to receive communication from higher spheres. And this can come in many different ways. People in meditation might have visions, or if in prayer might have visions. And information can come in dreams. And Lincoln had dreams of his son after he had passed away, talking with him. He also, as a young man, even as a young man throughout his life, had a dream that he would achieve some high place in life and then have a bloody fall from that. And when he died, his wife said his dream had come true. and so on. He had many, once when he was at home in Springfield, right before they were about to leave for Washington, he was lying in bed and he looked and he saw his face in the mirror, but the face was like cracked in the middle, and there was one side was very clear and then the other side was like vague. And he mentioned this to his wife, and she interpreted that you'll just have two terms of office in the White House, but you won't survive the second one. And
wow!
And she, what she predicted, and he thought that was true as well. That's what came true. So that's self-study. The last quality that he developed that he recommends is devotion to the Supreme Lord, it's really talking about, you know, having a deeply spiritual life, but also being very devout in your own spiritual practice, religion, or what have you. So the question that comes up is, how would a reborn yogi react to Christian America of the 1800s? What would he do? How would he relate to the Christians of that day? And the interesting thing was that Lincoln never joined a church, even though his wife did. He paid for the pew in the church that he did, went every Sunday, but he never joined a church. And in fact, as a young man, he wrote a tract against the teachings that were told him as representing Christianity, because and everything that he rebelled against were just the sort of things that a yogi might rebel against in the teachings excuse me, of Christianity of that day.
Okay. Take some water if you need some water.
Okay.
You're giving us great stuff. Now you're talking about the church. The church don't like when we talk about it.
Well, this is how I put Lincoln's rebellion. He wrote a pamphlet so that he might, in his mind, put all to rights. He pointed out the errors in many Christian tenets as those tenets had been explained to him, including were the innate sinfulness of man. A yogi believes that our souls are just a little drop in the ocean of God's spirit, so that we are essentially good, not innately sinful. He talked about against the supreme authority of the head of the church, the idea that Christ had atoned for everyone's sins and that therefore their efforts were not necessary. The teaching that the Bible was the only revelation of God, the accepted explanation of miracles, the concept of eternal hellfire. You know, Lincoln just didn't believe in that at all, and a yogi wouldn't either. There would be temporary experience of things like that, but not forever. And so these, you know, just the things that a yogi would argue against, the things that Lincoln did, and his, one of his friends took the tract after he read it, said, very nice, very nice. Opened up the stove and threw it into the fire. He said, I'm doing this for your own good, Lincoln, you know, and Lincoln was just frustrated. But when he became a politician later, he appreciated it because wouldn't have done him any help in that sphere. Okay, so those are the first two steps in the Eightfold Path. I'll go as quickly through these as possible.
Well, okay, all right, but keep quality. This is about quality.
Yes.
I mean,
quality.
Yeah.
This is all. This is the choice stuff. This is the really good stuff.
I'm enjoying this very much. So, thank you.
Okay, so as Patanjali said, as soon as you, when you're growing spiritually, you start working on fixing, you know, these things that are making you out of tune with spirit. You know, not doing the bad things and increasing the good things, the moral things. Then the next step is to sit without moving for a long period of time to go within. This is a journey inward, and after you kind of pack your bags by fixing faults in yourself, then you're ready to start making that journey inward. So you get in your car, which is your body. You sit straight, upright, with your spine erect, and in a posture that you can hold for hours on end without moving at all. And this is what asana means. But again, people point to this is the Patanjali talking about yoga postures. Now, we don't see Lincoln doing the headstand in the White House or big photos of him in lotus pose. But some of the postures, I used to teach yoga, and we used to teach inverted postures where you'd have your feet above your head so that the blood could come down and help to, you know, new blood into the brain was was good for health and good for your raising your consciousness as well. And Lincoln, okay. in his office, his law office, loved to lie there with his long legs in front of him, his feet up above his head, sit there like that for hours on end talking about law cases or whatever. It was just a habit that he had. No matter where he was in nature, he put his on a low branch, put his feet up above his head. Yogis who practice the postures have typically good health, high energy throughout their lives. Sometimes you'll see a yogi who's more than 100 years old with dark hair. Lincoln, you see photographs of him in the White House, and he deeply aged in the last few years. I mean, all that he went through, trying to hold this nation together, trying to get the Emancipation Proclamation pushed through, et cetera, and so on. Everything that he did, it really aged him, and there were a lot of wrinkles on his face. But in the photographs, you don't see any gray hair on him. And so this is just a sign. And his health was also incredibly good. I think he had one illness that I read about in his whole life. And he had incredible energy. Somebody was doing a study on his life, just looked at all that he had accomplished, all that he'd written, and he said this man was a workaholic. You know, he just was so busy all the time. He just had great high energy. Speaking of energy, the next step after you sit quietly, sit still, to be able to really do that, you have to have control of the energy in your body. Otherwise, you're just going to be trembling with suppressed restlessness after a certain period of time. So this is called pranayama, energy control. And those yogis who have mastered this can do incredible things with their body. They can lift great heavy things. There's stories of them in India doing amazing things like this. And the thing about Lincoln was he did the same thing as a young man. He lifted a 600-pound chicken coop and carried it a ways. He lifted a box. Yeah, he lifted a box of rocks that weighed 1,000 pounds using just a rope. He lifted this heavy barrel of whiskey and then opened the thing and took a sip of it and then spit it out because he never drank. This is one way that he was, you know, self-control. And, you know, it was just fascinating. One trick that he had that he did was a young man, he also did it in the White House. He would take an axe with a heavy axe head on the end. And in the 1800s, of course, metallurgy wasn't as advanced as it is now. So the head was even heavier than your typical axe head nowadays. And so he'd hold it at the very end of the handle straight down, and then he would slowly lift it up until his arm was level from his shoulder to the end of the axe head. Now, if you've never tried that, try it sometime. It is extremely difficult.
You know, I would imagine as something to do like what those gymnasts do with the rings, the male gymnasts when they're holding their bodies.
Yeah, the Iron Cross. Yeah, when they're doing the cross.
Exactly.
Yeah, they got
the
arms.
That was the visual
straight.
I had. Yes.
Yeah, it's like that. It's that sort of thing. There were
right on.
Yeah, now Lincoln, he was tall and thin. Actually, he's very much like me in physical build. Just tall. He's like 6'4". I think he weighed about 180 pounds. He was tall and thin, but he was very. Yeah, his law partner one time grabbed his arm, and it was like his muscles were stone. There were just so much energy flowing through. He had such mastery of the control of the energy in the body that he could do this trick. And others around him were looked more like, you know, Schwarzenegger or somebody. You know, so many military guys who were big, you know, and rough and, you know,
right.
You know,
right.
Early. They couldn't manage it, but Lincoln could. So that's
because I don't think it's about strength. I think if you don't have control of energy, that is what is doing that. You know,
right.
It's almost like defying the physics.
Yeah, exactly. Swami Kriyananda, who hardly exercises at all, when he first started the Ananda community here in California, one man who joined it was a weightlifter, and he was just this huge guy. He used to be a biker, and he had this big, huge arms that looked like tree trunks and stuff like that. And at one point, somebody wanted to just, you know, do arm wrestling. And so various people tried to arm wrestle this guy, and they couldn't beat him at all. And then somebody said, Swami, do it. He said, oh, okay. So he sat down, and he just thought, well, he'd been practicing pranayama through these various energization exercises that Yogananda taught, and through them he was learned to send lots of energy through his physical body. And so Yeah, so he grasped the guy's arm, his hand, and they said, okay, start. And Kriyananda just thought, okay, I need more energy, more energy, more energy, more energy. Wham! He had this other guy's arm down, and the guy just couldn't believe it. He said, do that again. And he did it again. And it was just like, this is mastery of energy control. Then you can...
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
You can do amazing.
The practical, you know, not that arm wrestling is necessarily practical, but the practical uses of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, like, I have used my energy to deflect a falling CD case from a 6-month-old baby.
Wow.
And I was sitting 10 feet away.
Uh-huh.
And it was amazing when it happened, but it clearly was coming straight down and then went to the left and then felt right to the left of the, you know, it did not hit the baby. And I went...
Yeah.
You know, I just intuitively went, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't plan it. It just, I couldn't get there. So that was the way I did it.
You just sent energy.
And it did.
Yeah, yeah, without
I
thinking.
Just, I literally was like, yeah, protect the baby. And I kind
of,
I don't know. It wasn't even like I pushed my hand. It was just all through intention, to be quite honest. And it happened that way. So
Yeah. The intention is will, and energy is directed by the will. And the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. That's something you
right
know.
On.
And when you're trying to protect someone or something, there are stories of these people who, just not very strong looking at all, and a car runs over somebody and they lift the car up or they tear a car door off or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
Grandmothers
and things of that nature doing that for their grandkids.
Yes, just the desire
to
help.
Yes, I've heard stories of that.
Yeah, it's sometimes that can happen when you're just not thinking about it and you just do it.
Absolutely.
If you develop your consciousness of energy and will, then you can do those things more consciously as necessary. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's funny, the more you can do it, the more it seems, it's really not appropriate, meaning there's an interference thing. That's what I'm learning anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you can doesn't mean you're supposed to.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's the first thing you check in. You check inside, is this the right thing to do?
Exactly.
Christ didn't heal everyone who came and touched him, or asked him.
Because it's not appropriate to heal.
Yeah.
There's no one answer for everybody. Everybody's journey is particular to their journey.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, absolutely. Some person might learn to something, and it just takes, you just have to tune in and just feel out what is right, and so on. So,
right on.
The next step after controlling the energy is you need to direct it correctly. You want to direct it within and up, up to the brain, to the spiritual eye and to the brain, to the higher energy centers in the body, from the lower up to the higher, and that is called pratyahara. And when someone, can sit in meditation for a long period of time, they control the energy, they direct it in and up, and then often they do what Yogananda called the disconnecting the sense telephones, so that, nothing, then you can go up to them, you can go, hey, like that, and shine a bright light in their face. They won't even know it's there because they've really disconnected everything, they've gone within. And they're tuning into the inner world. So,
right.
And there's a story of Abraham Lincoln where suddenly his wife whacked him on the nose with a piece of firewood. And he came out of this. He goes, I'm tired of talking to you where you don't listen to what I say. I keep asking you the same question over and over again. You are going to listen to me, and stuff like that. And he just mumbled something and whitewashed his nose off. He understood what she was talking about because he would do this spontaneously all in many different places and situations. He would be in the middle of a law case, and the judge would turn, Mr. Lincoln, and everyone would have to wait until he came out of this, where they said no one wanted to talk to him, no one wanted to touch him, because when you go in that state, it's like you look like everything is withdrawn, all your life is like withdrawn from your senses. So it's kind of, somebody sees that, says, oh my gosh, what's going on with this person? Are they sick or what? They thought it was all have to do with melancholy and stuff, but it was withdrawal from the senses. And so it's really interesting going through Lincoln's life and finding these things like little jewels. The next step is, darn, after you control and direct the energy, then you want to focus all that energy on one point. And so you use something, you can use a mantra, take something you visualize. Basically, you want to focus it on an aspect of God, one of the eight different manifestations, joy, love, light, so on like that. But to bring you into that state, often a mantra can be helpful. And there are not only brief mantras like it might give you in TM or something like that. There are also these long mantras that yogis memorize, like from the Guru Gita, where you could just talk for a long period of time. And it's all very powerful and very inspiring. And the interesting thing about Lincoln was that he had a poem that he used to recite to himself. And it was a decent length poem over and over again, and it was called Mortality. And, there's a saying that what is bright day is dark night for a yogi and vice versa. And so yogis would sometimes meditate like in charnel yards, graveyards, to remind themselves that the physical body was temporary, to go within, to find their fulfillment within, not in the body. Monks used to have these skulls as bowls to remind themselves of the temporary in the Middle Ages, to remind themselves of how temporary life is. This is a useful reminder to someone growing spiritually. It can be. And Lincoln used to recite this poem to himself all the time, and I'll just read a little part of that poem.
Here okay, great.
Yeah. Let's see, where is it? Why should the spirit of mortal be proud? There it is. Coming up to... Oh, why should the spirit of mortal be proud? Like a swift-fleeting meteor, a fast-flying cloud, a flash of the lightning, a break of the wave, he passeth from life to his rest in the grave. The last lines are, 'Tis the wink of an eye, the draft of a breath, from the blossom of health to the paleness of death. From the gilded saloon to the bier and the shroud, oh, why should the spirit immortal be proud? And he would recite this to himself over and over, and it was like a meditation for him. And again, most people think, oh, that would just make me depressed, but for a yogi, they would feel the joy inside, this is all temporary. I am spirit,
exactly.
I am immortal, I am not when the body dies, I don't die, and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, exactly.
So that's concentration, helping to focus the mind, and Lincoln had incredible concentration. And then these are the last two parts of this, dhyana, which is meditation. This is tuning into that one quality, whatever it is, and meditating on it and starting to feel connection with it. And in meditation, yogis, when they teach meditation, I was taught this, sometimes, often if you go into a meditative state, what happens is your breath slows down, your mind gets calmer, and then as you sit, especially yogis were taught to practice this, their eyes would go half closed, and they would look gently upward to the spiritual eye at the point between the eyebrows. Now, you may have seen paintings of deities in India with their eyes half closed, like Shiva and so on. You also see photographs of saints, like even, in Catholicism, with their eyes half shut. This is a natural phenomenon that happens, because you're going, the superconsciousness is at the horizon line between the conscious and the subconscious. You go through the middle there, and you go into the superconsciousness, and so your eyes are half closed, sort of depicting that you're kind of halfway between here and infinity. And the interesting thing about Lincoln is you look at the photographs of him, and those photographs were taken when photography was in its infancy. And so a lot of the time when Lincoln sat there, you don't see it, but behind him there's a metallic apparatus holding his body perfectly still. He had his knots move at all to get a good exposure, photograph. And so they had to expose it for like a couple minutes at a time. And so Lincoln would sit there without moving. And while he would sit there, his breathing would slow down, his mind would get calming. And then just quite naturally, his upper lids just started to lower until they were just about half closed. And you look at photographs of Lincoln and you see there someone who had the habit of when they didn't sat for long periods of time without moving, their eyes went started to go half closed. There you have photos of Lincoln, past life, meditating yogi. There they are. You can go see them. There are a number of them that are like that. Not all of them, but a number of them are. And there's also one when he had a painting done, they depicted him that way because he had just long stretches of time without moving. And so the artist said, well, that's the way his eyes look. That's the way I'll depict them. Lincoln had trouble. Yeah, Lincoln had trouble as a young man because his bosses used to say he's lazy. Look at his eyes, you know. Maybe he does a lot of work, but he looks lazy, and so they may not rehire him because of the way his eyes look, you know. So
much of our culture, even back then, obviously, was upside down and inside out.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Anything but lazy. You know,
yeah.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
You know, but so much of the culture. Okay, keep going. We're on a roll. You're doing beautifully.
Okay, well, the last step is called samadhi, and that means oneness. And there are a few times in Lincoln's writings where he writes in a way that makes you think he might have a sense of this. He says it is hard for someone to make you feel bad when you claim kinship with the God who made you. There are a number of other things, and I put them in my book. But the interesting thing about this, again, is that there's a teaching in yoga that before you can achieve spiritual freedom, you have to achieve union with God. And these are connected to the higher energy centers. Before you can go up through the crown chakra, which is at the top of the head, you have to go through the spiritual eye, which will then release a channel up to the crown chakra. And the spiritual eye is all about union with God. And then you go to the crown chakra and you achieve freedom. So there's a teaching in India, you know, this is very important for yogis, union before freedom. And the interesting thing about Lincoln was that he deeply wanted to free the slaves, but he said, before I could do that, I have to make sure that this union of states will survive. So in his point of view, even politically, it was union before freedom, which is a...
Oh, wow, he applied the same principle as a fractal almost, right?
Yeah, deep yogic teaching. Very interesting how he would apply... It was like he would apply yogic teachings to 19th century America. Another yogic teaching that was one that I really love, it's called Jata Dharma Tata Jaya, which it means is wherever there is dharma or adherence to right action, there is victory. And in one of Lincoln's speeches, you know, he ended up by saying, let us all agree that right makes might. And in that understanding, let us go on to victory. Which is a perfect, interpretation or another way of saying exactly the same thing, which is an ancient Hindu teaching. So interesting.
Right.
You know, there's one other thing I wanted to tell you about, and it has to do with, there are various branch paths of yoga. We don't have time to go into all of them, but I wanted to just mention one of them, which is called Bhakti Yoga. And Bhakti Yoga is union with spirit through devotion, through opening the heart, purifying the heart. And the way that bhakti yogis do this is there are various practices that can do them. One of the main ones is chanting, singing devotional songs to God, singing love songs, if you will, to God. And very sweet. And some of those, there is a tradition in India of something called bhajans. And these are long songs in which someone is singing a love song to God. And one of these songs I wanted to mention in our interview today is called Gokula Chandra. And it's the song of a woman who's a milkmaid in the time of Krishna. And all the milkmaids were in love with Krishna, who was, you know, an incarnation, divine incarnation on earth. And they saw him that way and understood him. And it was very, the whole story is an analogy. It's a very deep spiritual one. But she is singing to him because he has gone away. And so it is a melancholy song. It's a sorrowful song, but it is also a very sweet song. It says, where have you gone? I will give up everything. I will take up the garb of a yogini, of a woman yogi, and I will go to Madhura where you live. She says where that cruel one lives, because he's cruel because he stole her heart and then left her. And then she says, to find him, I will knock on every door, meaning in every wisp of inspiration she would seek his presence. And then she said, though his consciousness is infinite, in India they say that the Lord is the prisoner of those who love him. And so she says, I will bind up that fickle one in my sari and drag him home with me. It is very sweet. But I'm going to sing just a few lines to get a sense for the melody of that song.
Okay.
And then there's a reason for this, and it's connected with the life of Lincoln. Just listen to the melody a little bit. I'm not a professional singer, but I'll do the best job I can.
It'll be wonderful, I'm sure.
Oh, thank you, Goldie. Hold on. Jodi Gokul Chandra Rajinaye La Shakti Go Gokul Chandra Amar Jimban Manana Purushottana Kancheri Shuma Bello Gokula Chandra. And it goes on for about 10 minutes like that. It's very sweet.
Very
nice. And
very, by the way, somebody in the chat room said sweet. They enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Yeah. It is a sweet song,
yeah,
isn't
Janine.
It? Yeah,
yes, it is.
But it's almost like mournful. And it has that sorrowful sound, that sad song. And Lincoln loved songs like that. They didn't have bhajans in 19th century America, but they had these long, you know, torch songs, or, you know, these ballads that people would sing, you know, if they, you did me wrong and I'm in pain and I miss you, or I don't want you anymore but I still love you, you know, whatever people would sing,
right,
and the way they would
right
express it then. Lincoln loved those songs. One time he was in St. Louis and there was a woman singing a sad love song like that, and Lincoln, who was very, at that point still he is, very shy around women, still he said, "I please teach me that song, write down the words of that song," and she was very you know, flattered that he enjoyed her singing so much that he wanted to remember it.
Mm.
But any song like that, he had his bodyguard, was a really tough guy, had a great voice, and he would ask him to sing these songs to him. But there was a song that was written by Swami Kriyananda, Yogananda's disciple, that I thought captured the sort of sad but beautiful music that Lincoln loved, and would have been perfect for a yogi who had been reborn and was just hearkening back to these old bhajans that he used to listen to. And so I'm going to play just about a minute of this really quickly to get a sense for this. It really, I think, captures also the sense of Civil War time as well. So
okay.
I'm going to put the phone thing up near it. I hope you'll hear it well. Here it goes.
I'm sure we will. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
It's called it's called The New Dawn, and it's I forget the name of the it's from a CD called The Mystic Harp that features Derek Bell from the Chieftains. He was a friend of Sonic Green.
Can you send me that YouTube video? Because I can post it on my wall and let people. Because Janine and Simon both in the chat room found it beautiful. So.
Oh sure, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'll go ahead and do that. It actually is connected to right after that. I go and talk about my book, but yeah, I'll go ahead and send you the link. You know, and
That would be great because I'll post it on my wall, and this way, you know, because you know we only got a taste. You know, you gave us nuggets there.
Yeah, I hope
but it was beautiful. Yeah. Now, and they even said it sounded very Celtic and Irish.
Yes, actually, because it's actually kind of the Celtic feel to it too. But it also, you know, if you've seen like Ken Burns' special Civil War, PBS special on the Civil War. They had a song there that was also that had a similar feel to it, very sort of sad but also beautiful, and it was actually composed in the 20th century for like a bluegrass festival or something, and it was called Somebody's Lament. I forgot, there was something like that, and when they played it for the Civil War, it just perfectly captured that time period because
right,
it's a sort of melody that they would have loved. And in fact, in Garrison Keillor, in one of his shows, he did it in, I think it was in Richmond, Virginia. And he was talking a little bit about the Civil War, and they played that song. And the Civil War is still very real to a lot of people in the South. To them, it, you know, it hasn't really gone away. At the end of the song, you could hear the audience weeping. And Garrison Keillor gamely trying to make jokes and tell funny stories, and there was still, you could hear the weeping in the background. It was like,
wow.
Oh, we didn't expect this, but
it triggered emotions.
A lot of emotions.
It was an
emotional thing for a lot of people. It still is for some.
Well, especially if they're still living in that, you know, on the, at some level, then.
Yeah.
That would keep it alive.
Yeah.
Richard, I want to make sure people know where to find your information, find the book. I mean, you clearly tickled their, you know, their curiosity on Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well,
so
thank
please
you so
much. Share your... Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, I have a few books out, but we're talking today about the reincarnation of Abraham Lincoln, and that book is available brick-and-mortar bookstores like Barnes & Noble and so on. Also available on Amazon.com. You can also find it direct from the current publisher, which is Crystal Clarity Publishers, crystalclarity.com. And if you want just more information about me and all my books, I have my own website, which is the quickest, easiest way to get there is to type in LincolnReincarnation.com, and that will take you right to the website.
Outstanding. Outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
So, you're fantastic, as always.
Thank you, Goldie.
I really enjoyed today. Thank you. This was a beautiful way for me to spend a Tuesday afternoon. Any closing thoughts or statements or ideas or any?
Yeah. One thing I recommend for if you're interested in reincarnation, your own past lives, I think the best way is to learn to meditate, because in meditation you realize that you're not the physical body, you're the spirit residing temporarily in that body. Then when you have that degree of distance, you could say, oh, not only am I just temporarily residing here, but I also temporarily resided there. And you can just find out your own past lives through meditation. And if you're interested in learning more about that, contact me. Go ahead and contact me through my website. So.
Outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Outstanding. Well, thank you very much. This is really a very delightful 2 hours. And it went by fast, at least from my perspective.
It went really kind of flew by. And thank you so much, Goldie. It's always a pleasure and a joy to be on your show. And you're such a wonderful host.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're beautiful. If I had to bring anybody back from my past, you're top of the list, my friend. So I really, really was. I just enjoyed connecting with you and sharing this. And of course, Lincoln the movie is out. You know, this is very. I would call it almost auspicious, as it's almost like Lincoln, on some level, as the yogi, as the Himalayan yogi, as well as Lincoln. You know, there's the presence of that right now. This is, you know. let's not ignore the signs, you know, just from the spiritual world that are clearly showing up. So,
yeah,
you know,
we're all buying your book, seeing
a movie.
And we're all tuning into him right now. And that's one thought I had when I was tuning into him. He was like a guardian angel to our country. So,
right on.
Yeah. So may his inspiration inspire us all right now. So.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. Thank you, Janine and Simon and DeKestrel and all the listeners that will listen in on the archives. I appreciate all your support. The next interview coming up, next week I have a bunch of nanny gigs. Tis the season. So we had Daniel Jacobs, he was scheduled for next week, but he's not going to come until later in December. The following week is Chuck Gallagher. And Chuck Gallagher will be speaking about his book Second Chances, which is he went from embezzling money as an accountant to speaking and being a talking about ethics and inspiring people to understand that what their choices are. He's an extraordinary human being, and he really is. Second chances are available to all of us, so I'm excited to have my conversation with him as well. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much, Richard, for being here. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, God, Goldie. God bless you.
Bless you. So we'll talk to everybody next Monday night, 8 o'clock, the Mystical Mother Earth Show. I love you all. Thank you for coming. Bye now.
You've been experiencing Another Reality Show with Golden Hawk. Another Reality Show is live Thursdays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, or listen and be enlightened anytime that works for you. Questions or comments? Email the show, goldenhawkfeather@yahoo.com. That's goldenhawkfeather@yahoo.com. Also, visit us on the web at www.anotherrealityshow.com. Remember, all you rule breakers, misfits, troublemakers, all you free spirits and pioneers, all you visionaries and nonconformists, everything the establishment has told you is wrong with you is actually what is right with you. You see things others don't. You're hardwired to change the world. And unlike 9 out of 10 people, your mind is irrepressible and you were born to be a revolutionary. And here at Another Reality Show, we salute you. Stay amazing and keep on flying. Good night.